We are continuing in our study of David. Of course, it's been a couple weeks since we did this. We've done sort of the introduction and the first few stories in David's life. We are not going to go over all of the things about David in the story, which is a lot of text in the Bible. Probably it's up there with Jesus and Moses in regards to words written about them. So we're not going to go over all of the stories of David's life. We are going to go over a lot of it, though. We're going to go over a lot of it. And especially the times when we're doing three chapters tonight, 18 through 20. We're obviously not going to read three chapters, but we are going to hit the highlights and we're going to talk about the story. And what we're trying to build is a picture of David's life. What about David and his life made him such a pivotal person in the history of God's people? What made him, essentially, and we have asked this before, what made him a man after God's own heart, essentially? And we're building the context of his life and his situation up until he becomes king. Of course, he really comes onto the scene first in his choosing to be king, but he doesn't become king right away. There's a lot of stuff that happens leading up to him becoming king. And we need to remember, of course, Saul's backstory. We've talked about this already. I'll just hit it briefly because it's been a couple weeks. Saul, chosen to be king, didn't really want to at the beginning, reluctant king, eventually made king, and has a sequence of sinful interactions with God. One, he is commanded to destroy the Amalekites utterly. He decides not to do that. He decides to keep the calf or the cattle and the king alive, and he keeps the best of the things instead of destroying them utterly. And God's like, no, you shouldn't have done that. I told you, well, Samuel really says it for God. I told you I wanted you to destroy everything. Why didn't you obey me? And Saul tries to make excuses, right? Oh, I wanted to offer this to you. Oh, the people thought we should do this. And then, of course, the second time was he's waiting for Samuel to make a sacrifice before going into battle. He's waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And where is Samuel? And he just decides, Saul decides to offer the sacrifice himself. And that was a bad choice. And so because of those two things, and I think more specifically because Saul was not repentant, he made excuse after excuse, he did not confess, he did not have a humble attitude about it, God says, I'm taking the kingdom from you. You will not, your descendants will not be on the throne. And then, of course, we have the introduction of David. So as we go into this next chapter, we've read David and Goliath. Now the next section of the text is really David and Saul's family. Now this is not all of it, but this is sort of the main point of the next three chapters. And I'm going to leave this up there. We're going to read some of these verses. We're not going to read all of them. I'm going to leave that up there for a little bit as we talk about these things so that you can kind of get the flow of how the story goes. Again, we're not going to read all of this text. But of course, we begin with the success after the defeat of Goliath. And we will read this in 1 Samuel 18, 1 through 3. The introduction of Jonathan, who I want to note as we begin, Jonathan should be David's direct rival. Right? He should be that. Saul is the king. Jonathan would be king. David is the one that's chosen to replace, essentially replace, not Saul. He's chosen to replace Jonathan as the next king of Israel. And yet, it's interesting how this progresses. When David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan and David became bound together in close friendship. Jonathan loved David as much as he did his own life. Saul retained David on that day and did not allow him to return to his father's house. Remember, previously he had been going back and forth, caring for the sheep and then coming and playing for Saul and then going back and forth. He doesn't allow that anymore. Jonathan made a covenant with David, for he loved him as much as he did his own life. Again, speaks a lot about Jonathan. I do wonder, eventually it's going to be overt. Saul figures it out pretty quick. Oh, this guy's going to replace me. I don't know how much Jonathan is aware of that at the beginning. It's hard to say how much of that he's aware of. Saul definitely figures it out pretty early on that this is going to be the next king, not Jonathan. But Jonathan, I'm not sure, is aware of that. Either way, he develops this close friendship. And after that, of course, David has success in every battle. Saul keeps sending him out in military situations, and he has success after success. He's leading the armies. Everything's great. And of course, that leads us to the next section of Saul's jealousy, 1 Samuel 18, 6 through 8. When the men arrived after David returned from striking down the Philistine, the women from all the cities of Israel came out singing and dancing to meet King Saul, and they were happy. as they played their tambourines and three-stringed instruments. The women who were playing the music sang, Saul has struck down his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. And, you know, if you're the women there, maybe have some tact. Think about who you're singing in front of. They're singing this right in front of Saul, guys. And this made Saul very angry. The statement displeased him, and he thought, they have attributed to David tens of thousands, but to me they have attributed only thousands. What does he lack except the kingdom? And, of course, the answer is nothing. And so there's a lot of jealousy here. We're gonna skip until verse, I think the next verse is verse 20. Here we have the instance of, this happens twice, where Saul is in the presence of David's in the presence of Saul. He's playing the instrument. He's comforting Saul as he has many times before. And this evil spirit that comes upon Saul and he tries to kill David. And then David runs away. There's a bunch of things that go on. Then Saul tries to trap David a couple of times. We're not going to read this. He thinks, I'm going to marry David off to my first daughter. She will be a snare. What does it say about your relationship with your daughter that you think, oh, if I marry this person off, then my daughter will be a snare to him? That's not very great for his daughter. That doesn't work. David's like, no, I shouldn't be marrying the king's daughter. I'm just a lowly shepherd. I don't deserve that. That's David's basically response. So he doesn't marry Saul's first daughter. Then he says, okay, I'm going to send him to the Philistines. If I keep sending him out in battles, eventually he's going to die. Essentially, ironically, I don't know if this is the right word for ironically, he tries to do to David what David ends up doing to Uriah, just sending him out to battle over and over again until he dies. And that, of course, doesn't work either, right? 1 Samuel 18, 20 through 21. I like this picture of angry Saul. Look how angry he is. He's a very angry person. Now, Michael, this is the second daughter. Saul's daughter loved David, and when they told Saul about this, it pleased him, and Saul said, I will give her to him that she may become a snare to him. Again, not a great idea of thinking about his daughter. And so the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So Saul said to David, today is the second time for you to become my son-in-law. And he does eventually become, he does marry Michael, and becomes the son-in-law of Saul. Goes out against the Philistines over and over again. Battle after battle after battle, victory after victory after victory. And Michael ends up loving David so much, of course, that she eventually, we'll read this later, she chooses essentially David over Saul, her own father. And things are not going well for Saul. And this is the way it ends up. 1 Samuel 18, 28 through 23, after David has victory after victory after victory. When Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that his daughter Michael loved David, Saul became even more afraid of him. Saul continued to be at odds with David from then on. The leaders of the Philistines would march out, as they often did so. David achieved more success than all of Saul's servants, and his name was held in high esteem. Not going great for Saul. Now, of course, we know why this is happening. This is very much the plan of God, right? The hand of the Lord is with David in all that he does, to make him blessed and to make him be victorious. And of course, we can kind of look at this from both perspectives. On the one hand, yes, we know that God is creating this victory for David. But on the other hand, David trusts that God is going to do that. Saul did not trust God. That was ultimately his downfall in the previous two stories, is that he did not trust God either to wait for Samuel to come make the sacrifice, or to trust God that what he wanted was better than what Saul wanted. Saul did not trust God. David did. David trusted, and so God blessed him. And so as we keep going, now we switch into more of David and Jonathan, or David and Saul and Jonathan, where Saul and Jonathan throughout this story, and we get more into him in chapter 19, Jonathan is angry at Saul. What has he done? Why do you hate David so much? You gave him your daughter. What has he possibly done to make you upset? He gives you victory after victory in battle. And really, any esteemed general, generally the king, would love the great general, the great warrior, the great conqueror, and he would lavish on him praise and lavish on him blessings and esteem. But Saul does not want to do that for David, and Jonathan is confused. What is going on? And so Jonathan sort of goes to Saul and says, hey, you got to treat David better. You got to do better than this. And Saul does accept, at least temporarily, chapter 19, verses 6 through 10. Now Saul accepted Jonathan's advice and took an oath, as surely as the Lord lives, he will not be put to death. Then Jonathan called David and told him all these things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he served him as he had done formerly. Of course, he had to run away the last time because he almost killed him. Now once again there was war. So David went out to fight the Philistines and defeated them thoroughly, and they ran away from him. And then an evil spirit, the same evil spirit from the Lord, came upon Saul. He was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand. Who just sits around with their spear in their hand? I wonder that sometimes. Who's just sitting around holding a spear? I'd be like you, just sitting around holding your gun for no reason whatsoever. You're in your own house. You're not under any threat. You're just holding the gun for no random reason. That's what he's doing here with the spear. While David was playing the lyre, and Saul tried to nail David to the wall with the spear. But he escaped from Saul's presence, and the spear drove into the wall. What is that? The details are in here are interesting. The amount that the force with which he threw the spear, it drove into the wall. It was not like some warning shot. He was trying to kill David, and David escaped quickly into the night. We'll talk about the evil spirit in just a minute. And so we come to story after story after story. Saul's daughter. Okay, David runs away to Michal, his wife, Saul's daughter, and Michal hides him. Essentially, the king's men are chasing after David, and Michael's like, run away, I'll lower you down, and she does the classic cliched trope of sticking something in the blanket and then putting like a wig on the bed. This is literally what happens in the story. She creates this like lump under the blankets and says, oh, he's sick. You can't go in there. He's sick. And then, they eventually go in and are like, why did you trick us? And how must that have felt for Saul to realize now not only has he lost eventually the kingdom, he's lost his son and he's lost his daughter. All to this guy. And so David flees to Samuel. This is a really funny story. Again, we're not going to read it. I would really encourage you to read 1 Samuel 19, 18 through 24. So Samuel is at a place that I forget the name of. Can't remember the name of it. It's irrelevant for right now. He goes to Samuel at this place, and Saul's like, go get him. We know he's over there. Go get him. So he sends a bunch of soldiers over there. And as soon as they approach, the Spirit of the Lord falls upon them all, and they all start prophesying uncontrollably. And so Saul sends another battalion of soldiers. They all start prophesying uncontrollably. And then Saul's eventually like, fine, I'll go get him myself. And he approaches Samuel, and the Spirit of the Lord comes on him, and he starts prophesying uncontrollably. He even strips down naked and rolls around on the ground prophesying. Because again, God does not want Saul to kill David, right? God is very much supernaturally protecting David. And so again, we have this conflict between David and Jonathan and Saul. And David warns Jonathan, hey, Jonathan, and you know, you're best friends with this guy. Your father's trying to kill me, man. And Jonathan doesn't want to believe it. Rightfully so, right? Nobody wants to believe that about their dad. If Keith came to me and said, Chris, your dad's trying to kill me, there's no way I'd believe you. I just wouldn't believe you. It's not in my dad's character. That's probably what Jonathan thought, right? No, my dad wouldn't do that. Surely not. And so they have this discussion back and forth, and David sets up this scenario. Okay, we're going to have this dinner. I'm supposed to be at this dinner with Saul. I'm not going to go. If he asks about me and you say, oh, he had to go do some other thing, and if Saul gets angry, you'll know he wanted to kill me. But if he's not angry, he's just like, oh, I guess he's not here. Then okay, maybe I'm not in danger. And so, of course, that happens. They have this family dinner. Saul's like, why is David not here? Jonathan said, oh, he had to take care of this other thing. And Saul gets angry. And this is what he says in chapter 20, verse 30. Saul became angry with Jonathan. And here's where we get it. All throughout this story, there's this undercurrent that Jonathan really should not like David, right? Jonathan is the rival of David. Jonathan is the one who's going to lose the throne because of David. And Saul just comes out and says it. Saul became angry with Jonathan and said to him, you stupid traitor, don't you realize that it is to your own disgrace and to the disgrace of your mother's nakedness that you have chosen the son of Jesse, chosen him over presumably Saul, right? That's the implication. You've chosen the son of Jesse over me, over yourself. For as long as this son of Jesse is alive on the earth, you and your kingdom will not be established. Now, I don't know. It's hard to say. Saul knows that God promised him He would not be king. His family would not be king anymore. The kingdom would be taken from him. Saul knows that. Saul knows that David is having victory after victory after victory. Saul knows that the people love David. I don't know if Saul knows about the anointing with Samuel. If Saul literally knows God has actually chosen David. Or if this is much more of Saul's paranoia, right? The people love him. As long as he's alive, your kingdom will never be established because the people will choose him over you. I don't know what Saul's thinking about here, but very much he just thinks that Jonathan should be on his side, right? Why? Now send some men to bring him to me, for he is as good as dead. And Jonathan responded to his father Saul, why should he be put to death? What has he done? And this is, I think, the most important thing about Jonathan, is that Jonathan cares more about what is right than what is good for him. Jonathan only cares about, is this just? Is it fair and right that you should kill David? What has he done? And Saul, of course, does not have anything, and so what does Saul do? He throws his spear at Jonathan in order to strike him down. He doesn't succeed. Again, he's obviously not very good with a spear. Maybe that's why he didn't want to fight Goliath. And so we saw Michael chose David over her own father. Here we see Jonathan chose David over his own father. And Saul is ultimately left isolated and alone because of his selfishness, because of his refusal to submit to God's will and his refusal to admit that he's wrong, which is ultimately what this all comes back to. And so we have the story at the end here. Jonathan warns David. There's the story of them and the arrow, and they meet in the field, and this is how it ends up in verse 41, as they're all very sad. When the servant had left, David got up from beside the mound, knelt on his face to the ground and bowed three times. Then they kissed each other, and they both wept, especially David. Jonathan said to David, go in peace, for the two of us have sworn together in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord will be between me and you and between my descendants and your descendants forever. When he says that, the Lord will be between me and you, that's not like antagonistic, right? But the Lord is going to bind us together. The Lord will bind us together and our descendants together. And so at the end of all this, Saul is left alone and isolated with a broken family. Now, not only has he lost the kingdom, he's lost his own children because he was unwilling to admit when he was wrong. That's the root of all of this. And so while we think about the stakes might be elevated, human conflicts, they always arise from the same sources. And you probably don't have drama quite to this extent in your family. I don't think anybody's tried to throw a spear at you. Although we do know of family drama where people shoot each other, right? Because they don't like each other so much. I hope that's not your situation, but, you know, there's abusive situations and people are abusive and cruel to one another. It always comes to the same sources. Pride, jealousy, resentment, inability to admit we're wrong. That's the core of all human conflicts. Just like it was Saul's problem, it's our problem too. And so when we think about what we learn from this story, what was the root of Saul's struggle? His previous neglect of God's commands, that was bad. But then it was compounded by his unwillingness to make it right. Nobody's expecting you to be perfect. Oh, let me rephrase that. Nobody reasonable is expecting you to be perfect. Maybe some unreasonable people in your life are. But nobody who's reasonable is just expecting you to be perfect. We all know that we're going to make mistakes. But it compounds and becomes drama and horrible conflict and terrible tragedy when we refuse to make our mistakes right. To apologize, to reconcile, to try to forgive, to move on. That's when these things become insurmountable. I do think that if Saul had admitted his faults and humbly repented before the Lord, things would have played out differently. But because of Saul's unwillingness to do that, and then it compounds because he digs in over and over, he digs in his sin. He digs in his selfishness, in his pride. If we just let go of our pride, our jealousy, our fear, we can let go of these things. We can avoid a lot of conflict in our lives. Conflicts in our families. Conflicts in our friendships. Conflicts in, ultimately, our eternal destination. which is what we're thinking about. Kind of evocative of Pharaoh in a way. We talk about that evil spirit from the Lord. God had pronounced a judgment upon Saul. The judgment was what? Because of your sin, because of your pride, you will not have the kingdom anymore. And, you know, you think about this evil spirit from the Lord. What does that mean that did that? I do think that, like Pharaoh, God was making sure that his judgment would play out in the life of Saul. That Saul's life would be full of conflict and strife and jealousy because Saul had chosen to be that way, and God would not allow him to avoid the consequences of his actions. Just like Pharaoh in Egypt. Because God has a better plan for Israel. And of course, what can we learn from Jonathan? Ultimately, what do we learn most of all is the willingness to do what's right despite personal cost. Do you care more about what's fair and right and just than you do about personal advancement? And when is this going to come up most? You're not going to be the king of anywhere, probably. It'd be very unusual if you were. But we can think about this at work, right? Putting our own career advancement ahead of what is right, the temptation to lie, the temptation to discredit others, the temptation to be cruel and cheat instead of submit to what is fair and right and just. You think about this in relationships too, don't we? That rather than what is fair and right, I want my way. But what does Paul say in the Corinthian letter about love? Love does not insist on its own way. Does not rejoice at wrongdoing, rejoices with the truth. Jonathan ultimately put what was right ahead of what was good for him. And because of that, ultimately, he will have what's good for him in eternity, I think, right? He, of course, did not have it in this life. The friends we choose over the family we're given. Many people in this room I know don't have great family members. It's not your fault. You're stuck with them. Nothing you can do about it. How we choose to respond to that. It was not Jonathan's fault that Saul was this way. It was not Michael's fault that Saul was this way. But they could have chosen their family relationship, even though they knew it was wrong. They could have chosen their family relationship over what was right with David. But both of them put this chosen relationship that they had built with this person, David, over the broken family relationship of Saul, which you can do too. If you have a broken family, the church is a place, and we've said this before, right? If you have a broken family, the church is the place to forge a new family, to forge those new relationships, to have this kind of deep, abiding, loving relationship, even though your own family is deeply broken. This has happened over and over throughout history. God has provided you for a place to find that again. If, again, we ask, what is your priority? If you have your priority on what is right instead of what is easy. Ultimately, what was the cost of Saul's sin? And we'll conclude with this. This is the last thing. We know, yeah, his descendants wouldn't be in charge. That's a cost. But that's not a real cost that Saul would feel, right? That his descendants would not be on the throne. He'll be dead. He'd be dead by that point. Wouldn't really matter to him. So there is this sort of long view consequence for Saul's sin, but there's a much more immediate personal cost. The cost to his sin was not just that Jonathan would not be king, which ultimately wouldn't matter to Saul because he'd be dead. The cost was your own family. That was the cost of his sin. When we persist in sin, ultimately, yes, we know eternity, that's what we're thinking about, eternal separation from God. But make no mistake, your earthly life will be worse if you persist in sin. You'll lose relationships. You'll lose, in some cases, health. You'll lose family. That is the deceitful destructiveness of sin, isn't it? That I think I know what I want. I think I know what's good for me. And I put those sinful things ahead of what I know is right. And at the end of the day, I'm left a broken, isolated person. Don't be like Saul. Pride, fear, and jealousy will destroy your life. Learn from Saul and Jonathan. I didn't have room in here, but Saul and Jonathan and Michael. Learn to let go of pride and a sense of what you deserve, a sense of what I deserve this, whatever it is, a sense of fear and jealousy. Let those things go and your life will be better. Amen? Your life will be better. That's right. If you learn from Jonathan and Michael and David instead of Saul. And so as we conclude, the invitation. Maybe your life is full of some of this horrible stuff. Hopefully nobody's tried to throw a spear at you. If that's the case, maybe you should go to the cops. But you have conflicts. You have difficulty. We want to help, right? Don't we? We want to help. Let us be your found family, your chosen family, so that we can fill that void as God would have us, right? Because that's what God wants, for us to do that for each other. If you need help, come while we stand and sing.